This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
It's a great pleasure to introduce Abigail Pogrebin to you. This is going to be a treat to listen to her and to learn from her. Many of you know that she has worked as a producer for Mike Wallace at 60 Minutes, for Bill Moyers on PBS, and has an extensive publication background, including writing in Newsweek, The New Yorker magazine, The Daily Beast, The Forward, and Tablet. And also, she's had a critical role. If you Google her, and then hit the video, you'll find all kinds of videos where she's a moderator. And as a good moderator, she always starts by saying, turn your phones off. So turn your phones off. Turn your phones off right now. Don't wait a minute, because we are being recorded by UCTV. And even your questions, and we don't want to disturb anything. So as she's a very, very good and very skillful moderator. I've seen a few of the videos where she's spoken and moderated at the 92nd Street Y, the Skirball Center, the Hartman Institute in Jerusalem. But she's also, and this is very important, she's one of our, I think, most articulate Jewish public intellectuals. And, you know, she has enormous wisdom, I think, in commenting on a whole range of subjects. I would argue to her that her first book, which was entitled Stars of David, Prominent Jews Talk About Being Jewish, is reminiscent of other books which take a snapshot of Jewish belief or identity, in this case, how many public figures, and I can only note just a few of them, like Dustin Hoffman, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Nora Ephron, Ed Koch, Barney Frank, Aaron Sorkin, and perhaps most surprisingly among all of those interviews is her interview with Mark Spitz, who some of you may remember from that, all of the gold. And but what is interesting, she pulls out of them how each of them understand their own Jewish identity as being themselves very central to the Jewish world, or being considered central by non-Jewish people. And I think it illustrates one of her great, great abilities, which is to take a single life and make it into a huge story in and of itself. Her new book, this beautiful My Jewish Year, which you can buy a copy of afterwards, she'll be signing copies, My Jewish Year, 18 Holidays, One Wandering Jew, is much more than a discussion of the Jewish holidays that she practiced over the Jewish year. The Jewish calendar, with its feasts and fasts, only is the structure to help her get to other issues which radiate out from Jewish time. It's also about Jewish identity, Jewish values, and Jewish life in the contemporary world. And at every step, she weaves into her narrative the thoughts of many other Jews, many rabbis, men and women. And at every temporal way station, if you can call them, these chapters for the calendar and the festivals, her writing, as you will see, is fresh, it's vibrant, it's exciting, and most significantly for most of us, it's accessible. You really understand her. And she has such a wonderful sense of humor. So she has Simchat Torah, and I just love this. And she calls it Simchat Torah, chapter 8, the mosh pit. Just think about that for a moment, the mosh pit. And then it begins with her asking her family, would they want to dance with her in the Torah? And they all desert her, I believe. Her son says, I love you, but you're on your own. her husband says, "You're seriously going to dance with strangers?" And then her daughter said, "I have so much homework, Mom." We've all heard that at least a few times. So we have these books. I hope you'll take advantage of purchasing them. They're also available at Amazon. Chaucer's has a few if we happen to run out. And she will sign them for you immediately after our talk. And we have a reception for her. So please now welcome Abigail Pogrebin to speak on her amazing, demanding, indelible Jewish year.
Thank you. Very special thanks to Professor Hecht. I feel like I've had my bat mitzvah now and I can go home. That was an extraordinary introduction and a very big setup, so just be prepared to be let down. But, you know, we all have had a lot of Jewish therapy, so you'll get through that disappointment. No, I hope I don't disappoint. I also just want to thank Rabbi Steve Cohen. It's always amazing for me to have traveled as much as I have for this book around the country and see Jewish communities outside of New York, because in New York, you know, you're Jewish when you wake up. Just it's in the tap water. You don't have to work as hard. And at these other places where Jewish community is vibrant and urgent and relevant, I think are just the jewels in the crown. So I just want to say it's an honor to meet you. And on this gorgeous day, I'm just so grateful that you all are inside with me, because I'm not, you know, from this neck of the world. And when I woke up today, I just thought, why would anyone go indoors? It's extraordinary. So how many of you enjoy eating leftovers? Okay. Well, I married a man. His name is Dave. He's from Skokie, Illinois, who is allergic to leftovers. He doesn't want me to put any part of dinner in Tupperware, but I was raised by a mother who is evangelical about leftovers. She is passionate about all of the lunches that she can create out of one single supper. I know that it's entirely connected to her having been raised in the shtetl of Queens, New York, and she was born right after the Depression, so she is very oriented into saving and protecting and saying, don't throw that out, we can use that again. So I admire her industry, I admire her frugality. But Dave, my husband, who adores his mother-in-law, I assure you, inevitably expresses some affectionate anxiety whenever we're headed to my parents' house for dinner. He'll say, "Abby, how much of this meal do you think will be new?" Which brings me to the lox. Last January, and the date is important, so remember it's January, my mother called up and said, "Why doesn't your family come over for Sunday brunch? I have picked up fresh bagels from Zabar's." I hope some of you have heard of Zabar's. And she said, "I've defrosted the lox from Yom Kippur breakfast." For those of you who don't know, Yom Kippur was months ahead of January. So for my wonderful mom, who I think some of you may know, because her name is Letty Cotton Pogrebin. She co-created Ms. Magazine in the 70s. Yay! The few people who still remember Ms. Magazine. So she co-founded Ms. with Gloria Steinem and four other women. It was groundbreaking for its time. And she also co-created Free to Be You and Me. Some of you hopefully remember that record and that TV show. I'm on the TV show, 7 years old, by the way. I peaked at seven. It's on YouTube if you get a chance. I'm on with my identical twin sister, but I have a lot more air time. So if you're confused, just know the person talking is me. I'm sitting there with Marlo Thomas. It's very 70s. I'm wearing an outfit I regret, but I can't take that back. But my mom, you know, has confused people because she was an extraordinary pioneer from her day in terms of the women's movement. And people assumed that she was the crunchy, unshaven woman in cowboy boots. She was that strong feminist, but she was a very traditional Jewish mother at the same time, making me very crispy potato latkes, making sure we lit Hanukkah candles for 8 nights. Every year. We also had an amazing Hanukkah party. I just have to give her a shout out now that she's 78, because I don't know how she pulled it off. There were 70 relatives and friends. She got everyone a small Hanukkah gift. And in exchange, people had to bring some kind of entertainment. So it was a little bit of a quid pro quo. And Gloria Steinem, who, again, I grew up with, she's a closet tap dancer. So Gloria would tap dance on Hanukkah. I know it doesn't make a lot of sense, but it was a great memory. And also close to my parents was someone named Max Frankel. Some of you may remember he was executive editor of the New York Times for a while. He won the Pulitzer for his coverage of Russia. He gave the longest exegesis lecture at this Hanukkah party on the Maccabean Wars. So maybe that was up your alley, Richard, but for the rest of us, we almost fell asleep before the latkes got served. But what I'm trying to get a sense of is that we had a very Jewish home in terms of pride, in terms of a sense of what it meant to be a Jew in America. But what I had missed, what I never got, was Hebrew school, was a bat mitzvah, was the infrastructure of Jewish education. And I never particularly understood that there was this blueprint of the Jewish holidays, this roadmap through the Jewish year, that actually wasn't just meaningful, but demanding in a sense that could actually make one's life deeper, more challenged, and I would say more beautiful. Something that I'd miss, not to fault my mother, but because for all of her very deep Jewish upbringing, and that's a whole other story, she walked away from Judaism for a period of time. She came back very strongly, but I fell through the cracks. My twin sister, my brother, David, and I, we never got what I would say are the DNA of a Jewish education, which you can't always replace later in life. And that began to bother me. The fact that I had never learned the origins, the practices, and the power of every single Jewish stop on the Jewish way in the Jewish year. And I had a hunch, looking over at those who do celebrate these holidays, that they can't just have endured because they're sitting there. They can't just have endured out of obligation or Jewish guilt. There has to be some fire in these traditions, in these rituals, in this Jewish memory, in these texts. There has to be something that's urgent and relevant and powerful enough for people to keep doing it. And I wanted to know whether that was the case and and why. Why do these holidays exist? Because for whatever our faith is, whether you believe in God or you don't, I'm a believer, my husband isn't. In the world of Jews and outside Jews, we have, you know, faith is all over the map. But no matter what your faith in the divinity, in the divine, there is a recognition that these texts and these rituals came from human beings. And what I think is very confusing to most of the Jews I run with, and I run with a lot in New York City, is that for all of their education, most of us are fairly ignorant as to where these holidays come from, why they were created because they were, and how they've morphed over time in ways that are absolutely fascinating. Because if there's one thing I took away, and I took away many things from this incredible year, it was how alive this tradition has been in the sense of it changing over time, not being codified at Mount Sinai or even post First Temple or Second Temple destruction. But this is a tradition that has changed and evolved even to the point where in my parents' lifetime, new holidays have been added. So what did I do? I put my journalist hat on. As Richard mentioned, I used to be at 60 Minutes. I'm a fairly anal reporter, and I wasn't going to go in blind. I knew with great humility that I did not have Rabbi Cohen's ordination or his education. I would have to do a very deep dive and draw on teachers all over the country to take me through this. I approached The Forward, a newspaper I hope some of you know about. It's 120 years old. It used to only come out in Yiddish and then obviously English and Yiddish. I approached the editor, Jane Eisner, and I said, I want to do a Jewish year, not as a gimmick, but as a true journey and expedition, very deeply journalistically, but also deeply Jewishly. And she said, let's go. But one warning, one promise that she made me give her. Don't assume what's going to happen to you. Write about this in real time as you experience it. And don't presume that anything is going to be either clear, moving, difficult, hard. Just tell us what's happening to you along the way. And that's what I did. And it was challenging, mainly because there's like 15,000 Jewish holidays all at once within a span of 2 months at the beginning of the fall, as you may know. And then just keeping up, I was absolutely determined not to drop a stitch, ritually to figure out where I was going to go, research a holiday as thoroughly as I could, calling over 60 rabbis and scholars. I ran out of time and holidays before getting to every amazing teacher that's out there. Going to these places that I chose to go to, trying to be in it as honestly and fully as I could, and then going home, opening my laptop, and writing about it as soon as it was kosher to type. And after this year, it was an extraordinary experience for some ways that I will tell you without boring you with every holiday. But one of the things that was also striking was that I had an email address, and instantly people were emailing me with all of their Jewish input. You know, Jews are not shy. So they would give me their criticism. They would say, you forgot this. You must go here. You forgot to read this psalm. You have to read this book. But what was wonderful for all of the tsuris, the troubles that Jews will send your way, was just how instantly there was a laboratory that was on my laptop of a Jewish conversation, all from literally not just all over the country, but all over the world. And that, again, was the resonance of this, was how instantly, it's not just that people have opinions, they want to talk about something that may be as ancient as, you know, we're talking about the pyramids. So when I was doing my first book, Stars of David, which was the first book I ever wrote after being a journalist, and it was a scary thing to do because I wasn't sure a book could sustain interest. You know, when you've been at 60 Minutes, you're so used to taking a story, a complicated story or a profile of someone, and reducing it to 12 minutes. That's all you have if you look at this, unless it's an unusual piece. It's pretty much 12 to 15 minutes is all you've got. And here was a book for Stars of David. I was sitting down with, as Richard mentioned, Dustin Hoffman, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Stephen Pryor on the Supreme Court, Natalie Portman, who's back in the news again, Sarah Jessica Parker, Kenneth Cole, and I was asking them to be honest about their Jewish identity. I didn't want the perfect rah-rah, I feel so great about being a Jew. I wanted the true ambivalence of this identity, the joy of it, the difficulty of it, their family stories, not in a Hallmark card way. I had the tape recorder playing, and I asked them to be candid. And I think the book took off because they were, because these were not necessarily just your halcyon stories of Jewish identity. These were the true ones. They are, I think, moving, but they're also complex and difficult. And that book ultimately was, yes, I know, I'm honest about it. If I hadn't had celebrities in that book, it might not have had the traction that it did. But it was one interview in particular that changed me more than any other. And that was a conversation I had with someone who's not particularly the most famous in the book, although now, unfortunately, he's had some Me Too headlines. And that is Leon Wieseltier, who used to be, he's a very erudite academic and writer, who was then the editorial editor for The New Republic. And when I sat down with Leon, I told him that many of these famous Jews I was interviewing were telling me, you know what, Abby, Judaism just doesn't do it for me. I don't feel anything in synagogue, so I don't prioritize it. I raised my kids with some of the Jewish holidays, but we don't do most of them. I've let it go. And these were people who were among our highest achievers in America, whom Jews often hold up as our best exemplars of Jewish achievement. And what Wieseltier responded to me was not sympathetic at all. He wasn't holding my hand or making me feel better. He said, the problem, he told me, is that most American Jews make their decision about their Jewish identity knowing nothing or next to nothing about the tradition that they are accepting or rejecting. We have no right, he said, to allow our passivity to destroy this tradition that miraculously has made it across 2,000 years of hardship right into our laps. I think we have no right to do that, he said. Like it or not, we are stewards of something precious. It echoed two lines that he had written in his book, Kaddish, which I'd underlined before I met him. He wrote, "Do not overthrow the customs that have made it all the way to you. Do not overthrow the customs that have made it all the way to you. I suddenly wanted to pick up that gauntlet that he'd thrown down and say, I won't. I'm in. And so I began. And just to take you through a few of the holidays, and then I hope that you will buy this very reasonably priced book. It's a very good gift, and it's good for your shelf. And it's good not just for the Jews in your life or in your own house, but for the non-Jews, because we all know that we are having many mixed families and mixed relationships right now. And I purposely did not want to write a book that was pediatric, like here is what Hanukkah means for the first time, but I also wanted someone who has no idea what Hanukkah means to understand it. And so I'm hopefully walking the line between the very well-versed and the beginner. Let's just start with the summer. I had no idea that the Jewish holidays really begin in August when you're supposed to still be at the beach and wearing suntan lotion. Way before you get to synagogue for Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year, and Yom Kippur when you're supposed to pound your chest and announce and recognize all your sins of the past year, all of your flaws. There is the month of Elul. And during that month of Elul, you are supposed to start looking at yourself as courageously as you can, as nakedly as you can, to look at your flaws. And who among us really wants to do that other than therapy, which I've already mentioned? And even then, some of us are lying in there. This is basically built into our tradition, is saying, don't lie to yourself. Look at yourself. Look at who you are. So when I asked the rabbis, how am I supposed to celebrate this? How am I supposed to acknowledge or live this Jewish month of Elul before I get to synagogue? Many of them suggested I find a friend, a chevruta, a study partner, take certain traits. You can pick them as, you know, randomly. I chose a list that was very conveniently constructed already by a rabbi online, 40 traits for the 40 days of Elul. We took one trait a day and just looked at one trait. And at the end of that day, we would email each other our reflections about that part of ourselves. So one day was jealousy. One day was humility. Another day was courage. Another day was fear. And we would take just an idea like envy and say, when am I an envious person? How does it get in my way? Who am I jealous of? And just to take that one trait and look at one thing a day really changed atonement by the time I got to synagogue 40 days later, 30 days later. Because by the time you get to Rosh Hashanah, it's like you've been training for the marathon. You're well-oiled when it comes to looking at yourself. And to me, at least, and to my partner, and I've now done it every year since with someone different. My husband and I did it last year. That was very revelatory. This is not a very introspective man. I love him, but he doesn't love to unpack himself or his character. And suddenly we were doing that daily with each other. It was extraordinary. You're also supposed to hear the sound of the shofar every day of those 30 days of Elul. I don't own a shofar. The rabbi has one in his office, but most of us don't have one in our homes. So I went on Amazon. I ordered one. It's also very affordable, the plastic ones. The real ones are very expensive. I didn't get a real ram's horn. I got the ersatz plastic. And you know, they're very hard to blow successfully. They really are. And many of us have seen people fail. It is not a pretty sight. They get up at the bima and you're rooting for them, and then it's just like this really sad, pathetic toot that comes out when it's supposed to be a blast, and everyone tries to applaud and they feel terrible and it's awful. So this shofar comes with an instruction booklet, very conveniently. It tells you to practice by filling your mouth with water, standing over the sink, and spitting with control. So you can imagine my then teenage kids coming in the morning and watching their crazy mom standing over the sink, spitting. I took it very seriously. It was not very successful. My son Benjamin, I think he was then 16, he said, Mom, let me just try that. Boom, he nails it. He's just an absolute expert shofar blower, Rosh Hashanah ready. I said, Ben, this is great. You can fulfill the commandment. You can blow the shofar for me every morning. Of course, forgetting that no, at least, male teenager in my house wakes up before noon. So he already failed the mitzvah the first day. I had to blow it. My husband loved waking up to that alarm clock, I can tell you, for 30 days. But it was, with all seriousness, quite powerful to hear the sound of the new year in my home and to have that wake-up call that the shofar is supposed to be, that asks us to look at ourselves very, in a way that actually says, don't gloss over this opportunity. It's a chance to start again in a real way. Yom Kippur, I had never been to a mikvah before, the ritual bath, but Rabbi Yitz Greenberg, who's just a rabbi of rabbis, a great teacher, who wrote a book called The Jewish Way, when I interviewed him, he suggested I atone or cleanse, not just spiritually, but physically, and go to the ritual bath, where you have to take everything off. You're not just naked, you literally take off nail polish, any possible thing that gets in between you and the water. I'm not someone who loves being naked. I'll just put that out there, even though it's a synagogue. But there was something quite extraordinary about going with my daughter, Molly, and my twin sister, Robin, has a daughter the same age. That sometimes happens with identical twins. You have kids the same age without intending to. And so we all went together into our separate baths and chose. They give you an option of a blessing, a prayer to hear as you submerge. And it was quite incredible to think about the idea of refreshment and what it means to get another chance to set it right, to reset. For Sukkot, I went out to your coast, to L.A. For Sukkot, you are celebrating or marking the years in the desert after we had left Egypt. We were not sure whether we were going to ever get to the promised land, and we had to build these temporary shelters along the way. So I thought it would be powerful and actually more kind of beautiful from a temperature standpoint to leave the East Coast, which can often be rainy and cold in October, and go out to L.A., where there were rabbis I know and admire. And I sat in four sukkahs in a day and a half with four different rabbis. And I will tell you that Sukkot was a holiday that I'd sort of written off before in my childhood. We had always gone to synagogue on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. And that's a lot of hours of synagogue, and it's, you know, you're indoors and you're kind of done. And all of a sudden there's another Jewish holiday. It's like, come on. All right, already. And I sort of thought it was just this arts and crafts project, because I would always see people building these huts and stringing gourds and cranberries and things. And that's sort of not my thing. All of a sudden, when I started doing these interviews, I saw just the incredible themes that are in this holiday. For instance, the idea of fragility, which comes through again and again, the idea of impermanence, that nothing that we build is sure, is stable. And my God, you saw these fires last year, and you saw the hurricanes, and you saw people lose everything in Houston in a matter of hours. And that was drummed home so powerfully to me, the idea that we get invested and attached and complacent about our buildings, our stuff, our structures, and that this holiday is reminding us, be careful there. Don't get so attached to your material things. What matters is the people coming inside your sukkah, your family and friends whom you invite in. Not the structures. A sukkah has open walls, an open roof. You let the rain and the stars in. There was also some sexual imagery that I will not recount since we are in a shul. Very PG-13, another reason to open the book and to buy it. But quite shocking to me, fertility imagery with the lulav and the etrog and the shaking that goes on with those symbols on this holiday. And the sexual imagery, the fertility imagery was so surprising to me that I kept kind of pushing this rabbi who was the first to tell me. I said, are you sure that you're kosher here, that you're telling me something that you're not inventing? And he kept saying, Abby, it's in the text, it's in the text. And sure enough, when I cross-referenced it with all of the piles of books in my home and other interviews, that fertility imagery kept coming back again and again. There was a rabbi named Ed Feinstein out in L.A. Who is very bombastic and blunt, and said to me that Sukkot is actually a holiday that allows Jewish men to prove that they are handy because they can actually build something, which I liked a lot. He says that Jews think that Black & Decker is a law firm, which I thought was funny. That's probably a joke you've heard. I'd never heard it before. But one of the more powerful things that that Ed said to me was that what's amazing about Sukkot is that you've just been indoors in this holiday and these high holidays, breaking yourself down spiritually. And then essentially God tells us, or our tradition tells us, go outside and build something. You've come from this very internal breaking down. Now go make something. And to me, that was just a kind of a glorious and very echoing theme that happened all through the year, that in Judaism, we are often holding a very difficult place and then immediately going to celebrate. Let's fast forward to Simchat Torah. As Richard said, that's when, you know, you finish the entire cycle of reading Torah for the year and you have a party. This didn't used to be the case. The rabbis used to be 3 years that it took to read the entire cycle, and then they reduced it to one. Some still do three. And essentially the rabbis said, you know, we should make something of this anniversary. We should have a party. And so there's literally like a wedding for the Torah that happens. I had never been before. I asked all of these folks in New York City, where is the Studio 54 of Simchat Torah? They all said, go to BJ, go to BJ, go to BJ, which some of you may know is B'nai Jeshurun on the Upper West Side. So that's where I headed, and it was incredible. There was a line down the block and around the corner to get in on a weekday night to basically just dance with the scrolls. And these scrolls are, as you know, the Bible that are usually behind in the ark, very protected, around, you know, surrounded by velvet. You don't touch them except with a yod. They are very kind of precious documents, and suddenly they were out on the dance floor. It was amazing, as someone said, it's a celebration of the greatest book club in the world. Purim, who knew there was so much alcohol in the Jewish tradition? But it was quite extraordinary to me that not only was I supposed to drink single malt scotch, according to Orthodox Jews, on Simchat Torah, but on Purim, on Tu Bishvat, which is the birthday of the trees, which is back in January or February, you're supposed to have a Seder like you have a Passover Seder with 4 cups of wine, and you're mixing white with red. It's kind of disgusting, but, you know, when in Rome, you do it. On Purim, there is a fast. You know, there are 6 fasts that I had not known that we have to not abstain from eating 6 times in the Jewish calendar. I did them all, and I'm not going to get a trophy for it, but I would say that as a very enthusiastic Jewish eater, those were not the high points for me, although these holidays ended up being quite powerful. But on Purim, right, the day before Purim arrives, because you know the Jewish holiday usually arrives on Erev, the night before the holiday itself, there's a fast of Esther. And Esther was the heroine, I hope some of you know, who saved the Jewish people when we were going to be wiped out by the cruel, cruel king who she was married to, and his courtier, his attendant, I don't know what you call Mordechai, who was, Haman. And her cousin Mordechai comes and says, you have to save the people and go to your husband and tell him to stop it. And she does, and he does, and she literally saves an extermination. And with this incredibly sober story, we somehow have turned it into a totally raucous, inebriated party where we're supposed to get so drunk we don't recognize our enemy from our friend. But so we fast for Esther. Before we go into this holiday, we soberly take a moment to stand with her, because she's about to do the hardest thing. And I did that. I fasted, not realizing I was going over to Temple Emmanuel, where they ring in Purim with a scotch tasting. And there's the rabbi tending bar, essentially, before we went into the service. So I did as I was told. I tasted the scotch, and I was sort of keeling over before going into Purim. But again, I had just lost my father-in-law. It's happened unexpectedly during this year. And to see how the holidays rise to meet you in whatever you are experiencing, and right when you're supposed to go into this raucous, crazy party with costumes and masks, you also say Kaddish. Before that service, before you read the Megillah, before you do anything that might have that kind of frivolity, you take a moment to acknowledge those you've lost. And again, how many times in our tradition do we hold both struggle, sobriety, and exhilaration and celebration? It's extraordinary. And finally, to get to the spring Passover we just finished, we know that's the most famous holiday. They celebrated it in Obama's White House every year. It is that marking of an Exodus story, which has been a powerful story for many peoples through history. But what was amazing to me was how much we have missed that urgent call to tell it to your children. I think that at many of our Seder tables, the children only come awake when it's during the four questions. That's their big moment. And then they kind of get bored again and go back to hoping that the meal shows up soon. And that to me is a crying shame. And it's a mistake. And for my Seders, and I'm evangelical about this, the children don't just sit up and perk up during the four questions. They are integral for the entire Seder. They have to play a role either in asking or answering questions or bringing something that teaches us. And I would swear to you that a 10-year-old or an 8-year-old can teach us something about the matzah just the way an 80-year-old can. I also learned about the scallions. I don't know if any of you know about the scallions. In the Sephardic tradition, they put a scallion at every plate, right along your place setting. And during Dayenu, which is the song we sing, It Would Have Been Enough, and it's the famous song of the holiday, you're allowed to flog your neighbor with your scallion, to echo the whips of the of Pharaoh's cruel Egyptian slaveholders. And yes, it's a very sober memory, but there is that bit of levity at a Seder table, which we know already has a lot. You can only whip each other during the chorus, or it really breaks down into chaos and mayhem. But it allows you to work out any kind of, leftover resentments that you might have with your relatives or family members. And finally, to Shavuot. We get to Sinai. We get to the receiving of the law, the Ten Commandments. Essentially, Judaism is handed to us on that mountain. And yes, it's done with thunder and lightning and a lot of pomp and Charlton Heston, yes. But there's also the quiet voice that's in the text, the still small voice, that is really what it comes down to for any one of us who decides whether we are going to accept that law, accept that identity, or let it go. And just as I was deciding, I think, in this Jewish year, whether to stand at Sinai, whether to take my turn, not with, again, hubris, because I know I'm a small speck at the bottom of that mountain, but we all have to make that choice. Whatever's been handed to us, whatever we've inherited, it's up to us again and again, I would say year after year, to say, am I going to stand at Sinai again and accept what's been handed to me? This was my turn, and I said, yes. Thank you so much. You have time for questions? Time for questions, Richard?
So have some time for questions and comments, but we have to use this microphone so you can all be on UCTV. So who wants to ask the first question or make the first comment? Okay, I'm going to bring the mic over to you.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
I'm interested to know how your children responded to all of this.
Well, my children are now college age, and so I've to some extent lost them for a little while. But what I think they absorbed more than anything is my excitement. And I don't mean that we were having a circus in my house, but I do think what they saw was how interested I was in what I was learning and getting. And what I tried to do, because I've seen how it can backfire, if a parent gets excited about something and says, read this, do this, or do this with me, it doesn't work, was more for them to kind of, by osmosis, see what I was bringing home. And there are very many home-based holidays. So in addition to going to synagogues and sukkahs, I was also introducing things at our table that I think made them, fairly curious and interested themselves. And that's what my hope is that was contagious and that what they do decide is to carry on the learning and the exploring. What they also have inherited, which I didn't belong to a synagogue growing up, as I mentioned, we moved around for the holidays, but we never had an affiliation. And now my kids have. I joined Central Synagogue. I'm miraculously, crazily the president there. I don't know how that happened. That's a synagogue with 2,400 families. It's a Reform synagogue and a waiting list of 700. It is a vibrant New York place of worship. It's quite extraordinary and an anomaly, and I don't take credit for it. I am not the clergy there. But what I think they've absorbed there is a sense of having a Jewish home. The clergy know their names, their faces. They're welcome when they come back from school, and I think there's no replacing that. I'm leaving it to you, Richard, to choose people.
Hi, I loved your talk, and I love the book.
Thank you.
But you shouldn't be too flattered that we gave up a sunny afternoon to be here, because we have 360 more of them this year. I wanted to ask whether there were some holidays that you knew about that you chose to exclude from this, and if so, why? How did you make those decisions?
Great question, and thanks for making me feel less guilty. But also less flattered, so it's kind of double-edged. So it's a great question. First of all, the most important holiday is Shabbat. I was not going to tire everyone out with 52, writing about 52 Shabbatot is the proper plural Shabbats. What I did do was write about three, because I really struggled with Shabbat. I struggled with powering down. I struggled with going off the grid. I really wanted to. I kind of came a little ways there. I hope you'll read about where I struggled, because I think a lot of people do, but I see how powerful Shabbat can be. I also went to, I don't know if any of you know about the Jewish Service Corps called Avodah. When kids graduate from college, they can join this incredible service corps for a year where you're living in a home communally with other college graduates. You're deciding how Jewish you want to be in that home, and you're all working for not-for-profits to combat poverty, which is obviously a very Jewish value. So it's quite extraordinary, and I thought I should spend a Shabbat with those kids because I wanted to also see how Shabbat is lived as the Tikkun Olam idea, heal the world. And then the last Shabbat is coming back home to Central, and I describe that. So, but I left out a lot of other Shabbats, and I think people are grateful. I also left out Rosh Chodesh, which is the beginning of every new moon. You can call it a holiday. Some do, some don't. But I thought, again, that would be redundant, and it was sort of a separate direction. The last thing, though, which is sort of a holiday, is Tu B'Av, which is, again, debated. It's like the Valentine's Day of Judaism. And there was so much cloudiness over whether it was a holiday that I was like, Dayenu, I have enough.
You mentioned they learned by osmosis. Was that Moses or just osmosis?
That's very clever. Are you a rabbi? Okay.
Hi, I really enjoyed the book. One of the questions I had you answered partly in your talk was, what did you keep from your year experience? You mentioned that you've kept doing the 30-day kind of reflection before Rosh Hashanah. Yeah. What else has stuck with you? Or what have you added? I'm just curious.
I think, first of all, the Elul practice is something that my synagogue adopted. We call it sort of the Elul Project. And so that's been wonderful just because it pairs some of us up within the synagogue. And so that I've continued and will continue. And I take the same traits every year because I think it's important to not just to shake up those characteristics, but to actually look at the same ones and see if I've improved at all. And it's sobering to see how little distance I've come. I would say that what I've kept is a deeper dive on some of the bigger ones. So I try to go and learn in various places, and New York is obviously a smorgasbord of learning. So I will go to, they have something called a Yom Iyun. Am I pronouncing that correctly? Where it's like a day university at a place called Machon Hadar, an independent seminary. And I went before Yom Kippur for one, and I went before Passover for one. And it's either kind of three back-to-back seminars or morning to afternoon. And I try to sort of just deepen the learning around the holiday because it feels to me almost prayerful on some level, and it also keeps me alert. So I don't want to sort of get in the rut of I know what this holiday is, because for me, part of the what keeps them really alive and challenging is hearing people kind of excavate them again and again. Simcha Torah, I've been back for the dancing. Shavuot. The all-night learning that happens when you stay up all night on Shavuot. You're supposed to stay up all night and learn, because some of you may know I didn't. We almost overslept at the foot of Sinai, and the way that we're avoiding that is to basically make sure we stay awake. So I drank a lot of coffee and have cheesecake, which is what you know you can have, and though I usually avoid carbs, I OD on cheesecake. And I go to this all-night learning, which happens at the JCC in New York. It happens a lot of places, but it's extraordinary. 4,000 people show up from 10 o'clock at night to 4 in the morning, and there's 10 sessions an hour. So I've done that. Others, Richard?
Yes. Is your family also from the New Jersey area?
Yes.
I think we're related.
That's wild. My gosh.
Yeah, the Plotkin family.
I don't know, but I'll ask my dad.
Okay.
Let's talk after. My dad grew up in Roosevelt, New Jersey. I don't know if anybody even knows where that is. It's near Princeton and Hightstown. But yes, there's family there. So we'll have to explore that.
Okay.
I have a good question about have you had any criticisms from the ultra-Orthodox or about your book and your interpretations of these holidays? Mm. Is there any criticism, or is this... Have you had approval?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. I think that because I was the learner asking for help and going to them, many in the ultra-Orthodox community, as teachers, they were extremely supportive. And I don't say that just to kind of say that it was utopia. It was like the Disney of Jewish crowdsourcing. But it really was amazing how nobody turned me down. Where it got a little bit less hospitable was when I was moderating a conversation about Hanukkah at JTS, the Jewish Theological Seminary, which is conservative, as you know, in New York City. And I was encouraged to invite a panel of every denomination, and I tried. And I had renewal there, and reform, and conservative, and I had Orthodox, but there was no ultra-Orthodox representative who would sit on that stage. And when they explained it to me, it was quite stark, where they basically said, one said, and it's in the book, we will not dignify another rabbi whose Judaism we don't consider Judaism. It was literally that stark. And that, to me, was not the best of Judaism, and that's where my bias comes in, and not because I judge how someone wants to worship or observe, but the idea that you wouldn't even sit on the stage with other rabbis who are clearly scholars too and observant too and talk about a holiday we all celebrate and mark was eye-opening to me, but that's the way it goes. Right. Right. Rabbi's prerogative.
Yeah. Abigail, thank you so much. Thank you particularly for standing up as a non-rabbi and saying yes, as you put it, to give this a try. One question that I'm curious about is I think a lot of lay people feel or experience Hebrew as a huge barrier. And I'm curious, I'm assuming that you went into this year without a lot of Hebrew, and I'm interested in how did that play into the experience? Was that one of the big obstacles for you, and how did you navigate that particular challenge?
No, it's a great question. I learned Hebrew in college because that's when I began to feel annoyed by what I'd never learned. And I actually had this amazing Israeli teacher who used the Israeli Top 40 countdown to teach us vocabulary. And so I really still know the songs from 1983, if you're interested. But what was good about that was that it was accessible at that time. And then I thought it would still be there when I was starting this and saw how much I'd lost. And And as you know, if you're not keeping it up, it's extremely hard to stay fluent. What I did was I went on Craigslist and got a tutor so that I would at least try to kind of re-oil or reactivate the little that I had gotten. And this was a Chabadnik teacher who literally looked like he wanted to, you know, cry out to God that or pound his chest that I was like betraying the Jewish people with my pathetic Hebrew. I mean, he was supportive, but he was also like geschrying at how terrible I was. But what I think I realized is how much I am missing. It was taught to me. It was pointed out to me. You need to see how this word echoes that word. This is the third time that this has appeared, and it's in the Torah here, and it's in the Torah there, and that's very intentional. And I had teachers who were explaining that. But as you know, if that's not in your facility, you're missing it. And I had, I'll say, Michael Paley was very blunt with me, and he said, Abby, because I struggled for Yom Kippur, even as much preparation as I'd done, I sat in synagogue, and I still was like, where's the fairy dust? Why am I not being taken to another universe right now? And he said, you don't know how much you're missing. You know, you're doing, you know, it's good yeoman's elbow grease, but ultimately, you're missing things that would make this come alive for you that we know because it's in the Hebrew. And that's where, you know, the barrier is real, and I am not going to whitewash that. I think there's a lot of barriers for anyone trying to get into this game, because ultimately it's a very demanding tradition, and you get so aware of how bottomless is the learning that you can throw up your hands and say, I'll never know it. Why should I begin? I would argue the other, which is, and I don't have to tell you, do a little something new. Learn a little something different, because ultimately it speaks back to you and gives back to you in spades. And yes, you'll never know it all. And I would venture to say that the rabbis will never know it all either. And so to throw up your hands is a shanda. But I do think it's a long answer to say, yes, the Hebrew matters. Others?
Since your mother was so important in the Women's Lib movement, I wondered what your mother thinks of your book and your
new life
information and other women's livers, how it coordinates.
Yeah, thank you. Well, I have a very supportive Jewish mother and a very demanding one. But she has been, I think, both stunned and appreciative that I came to this my way in my own time. And what's been a blessing is that we are now asked sometimes to speak together, because she has a very interesting and different Jewish trajectory, and it obviously intersects profoundly with mine. But I think we're representative of a lot of intergenerational kind of Jewish paths, confusion, floundering, that gets you ultimately to the place, I would argue, like in Wizard of Oz, that you were supposed to end up. I did choose to become a bat mitzvah at age 40. That was something that happened after my first book, when I heard the famous people say that they kind of didn't care so much. It made me actually want to care more. And I, again, don't want a trophy for that, but I would say that that service and experience was profound, partly because it allowed my mother to be back on the bima with me, and she had always been so regretful that she never gave me a bat mitzvah. So that's a little bit of my Jewish family therapy. Do we have time before cookies? Yeah.
You briefly made a comment about your husband not being kind of the believer that you are. And I found that true in my family, where the men are mainly agnostics and the women are the ones that are more into that, into Judaism. From your travels and your experience in doing the book and all, have you found that to be the case, where the men just aren't as into it as the women are?
You know, I found that it actually varies. I mean, I would say that, you know, some of the audiences are all women because they end up being kind of federation lunches, you know, and that's a wonderful thing. And they're not learners, but they're, in a way, the keeper of the Jewish life kind of battalion. But I would say that there are some men who, you know, for whom it's not just a deal breaker if they can't continue that tradition, but they are struggling mightily to share their love for it. And what I hope with this, that this book does, and I'm not saying that my book is the answer, but I do think that what is unique about my book is that I'm a bridge between the rabbis and the lay folks, whether they be Jewish or non-Jewish, or marrying into or exploring Jewish friendship or Jewish family that says, this is it, here it is, all in one place. If you do read this or dip a toe into this, you may not choose it, but you'll understand it. And maybe it will be a less daunting kind of way of at least engaging the conversation. Because I don't think that necessarily people are going to suddenly go out and be observant Jews. But I think this conversation is one of the most alive and challenging and relevant conversations for us as human beings, not just as Jews. And that hopefully, if you're sitting and talking about Hanukkah, which we didn't even touch today, you are getting at some of the themes that we're dealing with literally right now in our politics and in our government. And if you're talking about Yom HaShoah, which we just marked, and what is the importance of memory? Why do we need to stand up in some way and remember 6 million people, and how can a day possibly be sufficient for that? Let's have that conversation about whether memory is important or in some way reductive. I think these kinds of conversations are not just the glue of us, but they keep us alert and alive. That's in a way, to me, it's low-hanging fruit, but if you get in the conversation, you don't want to leave it.
May I ask the last question?
Sure.
Which is a very small question, but I'm interested in the title of this presentation. You said, my amazing, and we certainly got that, right? And then the second is demanding, and we certainly understood that. But why indelible Jewish year?
You're a good professor. I think it's indelible because, you know, and I say this in the epilogue, it both changed nothing and it changed everything. And I say it changed nothing in the sense that, not nothing, but I cannot say that I am now going to be living an Orthodox life. That's not fair. I am a more observant person. That is true. I am a more involved ritually. I'm someone who is more devoted to the actual kind of Jewish requirement. But where it's indelible is that I honestly don't look at the world the same way anymore. And that's not an overstatement. It's the truth. And I think because to a holiday, every single one of these markers in the year seized me by the throat and said, don't take this moment for granted. You may not get another one. That's not morbid. It is just truth. And so be in it. Be in it fully. And think about who you are today. Because if you weren't going to get another year, would you make the same choices? Would you be with the same people? Would you have the same, do the same work? Would you have that conversation the same way? Would you forget to call your parents as often? It does, without being, again, too Oprah about it. It did change my perspective on preciousness, gratitude, and urgency. Thank
now,
you.
Wait. Before we thank you, this is really the best way to spend a Sunday afternoon. It's much better than being outside. So it's really wonderful that you came to visit us and to share this wonderful book. You're maybe Lantzman from New Jersey. Is that where you said you were from? He has to now buy 4 books, right? So don't forget. But we do have books outside for you. And Abby will be at the table and sign your books for you. And also we have a reception. We can have some tea. The cookies are really fantastic, I think. I sampled them before you got here, and I would recommend them. Thank you very, very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.